For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolf. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blogger. She has written about risotto for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today from San Diego. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So today we're going to talk about risotto. Why are people so terrified of risotto?
You know, I think risotto has gotten a really bad rap here in the United States. I think that people love to eat it, but they fear making it because of all of these horror stories that most people have about making risotto, that it takes too long, that you have to stand there and constantly stir for a half an hour or in really exaggerated stories, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, that it takes, you know, so much patience and so much attention to detail. But in fact, once you actually make risotto and once you start getting good at it, you realize it isn't that difficult. It's really just about following a series of steps. In fact, it only takes between 20 and 30 minutes to start risotto and then to have it actually finished and to sit down and eat it.
Why don't you walk me through the basics of risotto making so I can see just how easy it is?
Okay, first all you need is a wide, shallow, heavy-bottom pan. That helps distribute the heat evenly and to cook the rice evenly, and a wooden spoon. The next thing you want to do is you want to bring some broth, either vegetable broth or meat broth, depending on the risotto that you're using. You want to bring it to a simmer, and you want to add that hot broth to your risotto. The reason that it should be hot is that if you use cold broth, it chocks the rice and creates a rather undercooked, almost crunchy-centered rice that you really don't want for risotto. Then the first step you want to do is in this pan, you want to add some onions with butter or butter and a little bit of olive oil. And you want to saute or sweat the onions until they turn translucent, which is just a few minutes. And then you want to add the risotto. And this next step is really important because it's partly what makes risotto unique, and that is you want to toast it or you want to braise the rice. And what this does is when the rice gets coated with the fat from the oil or the butter, it prevents it from absorbing the liquid too quickly, and it results in a more tender, creamy risotto. The next step is adding some wine, which really will evaporate rather quickly, but the essence of the wine will be infused throughout the risotto, so it will have that wonderful flavor. Then you come to the part that everybody dreads, or a few people love, which is stirring. And there's some controversy over whether you should stir constantly or occasionally. And I can tell you from experience that you can stir occasionally, which is every 2 or 3 minutes, and still have a wonderfully creamy risotto. The key for a creamy risotto is to pour the hot liquid in slowly and to make sure that the rice has completely absorbed all of the liquid before you add more. And to also make sure that when you stir, that you incorporate all of the rice in the pan, even including around the edges, and this will prevent any scorching from occurring. And also make sure that you keep your heat on a low heat, because you don't want to have it too high, which could either burn the risotto or make the liquid evaporate too quickly. Then you want to taste it and make sure that it's done al dente, which means that it should be fully cooked, but it'll still be firm. And then the last step is called in Italian mantecare, which means that you turn the heat off, you add a knob of butter, and you add some freshly grated Parmesan cheese. And what this does is it allows it to melt slowly and just add some silkiness and flavor to the risotto. And then you serve it immediately.
The stirring is to just incorporate the liquid into the rice and make sure everything is coated and... So you don't have to do it constantly. You can do it.
No, because, for example, you add the broth about a half a cup full at a time. So say you pour that in. You can let that sit for a minute or two, and you'll see it bubbling, and you'll hear it bubbling. And then you'll start to notice after you do this a few times that you'll become more aware of the sounds that it's making. So that bubbling might start to slow, and then you look, and you notice that it's becoming thicker, and the risotto is swelling. So then now you know it's time to stir it again. See how much liquid is left in the bottom of the pan. And if the bottom of the pan looks dry, then you know it's ready to add some more liquid to it.
Now, let's talk about the rice itself. I thought you could only use Arborio, but it turns out there are many different rices.
Yes. Basically, there are three primary types of Italian rice that are used for risotto. And like you said, Arborio is probably the most common here in the United States, but in Italy they have several more. But what the three rices are, they're Arborio, Violone Nano, and Carnaroli. And what they all have in common is that they're all short grain, rather plump rices, and that they're all high in a starch called amylopectin. And this starch dissolves throughout the cooking process, and what it does is it gives risotto its characteristic creamy and slightly clingy texture that we love so much about it. The first one, arborio, has a slightly larger grain, so that allows it to absorb liquid a little bit more easily and lends itself to a creamy yet al dente risotto. And this is widely available in United States supermarkets as well as Italian specialty markets. I like to look for arborio that's labeled Superfino. That just indicates that it has a higher starch content and that it'll be an ultimately creamier, superior risotto when you finish. The second one is called Violone Nano, and that has a plumper grain, which makes it firmer after it's cooked, and some people like that better. And this is a popular type of rice in Italy, but it's not so popular here. It's a little bit more difficult to find, although some good Italian specialty markets here in the States should have it. And then the third one is Carnarole, and that's called the king of rices, because in Italy it's really prized for its delicate flavor and its satisfyingly yet really firm, yet tender, creamy risotto, although it's much more expensive, and it can be found usually online here in the United States.
Why can't you use Uncle Ben's?
You can't use Uncle Ben's because it's not the right type of grain, and it doesn't have the right type of starch that will release slowly that will create that creamy texture that you get from these types of rices.
Now, I go into restaurants now, and I see all sorts of risottos on the menu. In Italy, is risotto paired with seafood and vegetables and all of these things I see, or is this a new invention? Is it American?
Yeah, I think it's actually a little bit of both. In Italy, they do have it with all different types of meats and vegetables, like you were saying. And it also depends on the regional preferences. Here in the United States, risotto really didn't become popular until after World War II. And at the time, it was considered a great way for a woman to feed her family a satisfying, nutritious meal that would stretch a long way and not cost a lot of money. And so it didn't really become popular in restaurants here until the 80s. And since that time, I think that the types of risotto we see have evolved significantly, like you were saying. So we have, you know, everything from really humble risotto with just a simple marinara sauce on it to something sophisticated with truffle oil or lobster in it, and as well as dessert risotto. So again, I think it's something that continues to evolve.
Talk about the dessert risottos a little bit.
Well, rice pudding, I think you would agree, is a really popular American dessert. And I think most people make it with regular long grain rice. But if you make rice pudding with arborio rice, it is the most luscious, creamy rice pudding you've ever had. In fact, that's all I use now. I love it so much that I don't even use regular white rice anymore. And again, it has to do with that slow release of the starch. You don't stir it as frequently as you do when you make the savory ones. Usually when I make it, I just put it in a pan with some water and milk and sugar and spices like cinnamon or nutmeg and just kind of let it simmer so that it's slowly bubbling. And you let it bubble and you stir occasionally every, you know, maybe every 5 or so minutes until it gets really luscious and thick and velvety and creamy. And then you can do all kinds of toppings on it, anything from dark chocolate shavings to mixed nuts to some freshly whipped cream. You can stir in some poached fruit like poached fresh figs or prunes or pears. I mean, really, the options are just endless for it.
Oh, sounds fabulous. This all sounds so delicious. I am just really kind of drooling here. But well, I really appreciate all these tips and can't wait to go home and try this. Thanks so much, Susan.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie.
14 years ago, a California doctor went to France, where he spent a few weeks learning the art of making chocolate. He returned with a passion to try it for himself. And together with a friend, a coffee grinder, and a hairdryer, he began experimenting in his own kitchen. They helped start an American chocolate revolution. That family physician was Robert Steinberg. His friend was John Scharfenberger. Their company, Scharfenberger Chocolate Maker, is now highly acclaimed. We learn today of Robert Steinberg's death this week at the age of 61 of cancer. John Scharfenberger joins us now to talk about his friend and his business partner. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
How did the two of you meet?
We were neighbors up in wine country, Mendocino County, north of San Francisco. I was farming wine grapes and strawberries, and Robert had a small practice.
Why was he so interested in trying to do this at home?
Well, you know, Robert was a chef. He loved food. He was diagnosed, actually, with lymphoma quite a long time ago. And it really changed his life. And he decided to do the things he loved. And one of those was cooking. He studied in Italy with Marcello Hazan. And a friend said, nobody makes a good chocolate here in the United States. And I think it lit up in his mind. You're right. Let's make something that is more like the European standard. And so he looked around and heard about a very small company in Lyon called Bernichon that not only makes delicious candy, but they actually make their own chocolate. He wrote them, and they wrote him back and said, yeah, come on, visit. He came back to the United States really on fire to try and do this. So we began a really interesting project exactly in his kitchen with all kinds of strange things like a trivet and a mortar and pestle and a mix master and a convection oven.
Now, some of that makes sense, the mix master, the trivet, the hair dryer.
We wanted to keep the chocolate viscous while it was turning in the mix master, but we were very careful. You couldn't get it too hot. So the hair dryer just kept the chocolate liquid enough to actually keep it mixing around. Actually, after a while, we chucked that stage and just realized that by using the coffee grinder, we could get 80% of the flavors we needed to out of a bean. Frankly, I tell people this all the time. They can make their own chocolate at home using cocoa nibs and you know, a coffee grinder, and it's pretty good.
How were you able to do this, to create this company under the shadow of Ghirardelli, since you were both based in San Francisco?
Well, we weren't trying to start a company. We were trying to make something that was really delicious. It was more a labor of exploration. Let's try and make something we really like. And, you know, maybe we could sell it to our friends eventually. You know, rent the little place, make a little bit of chocolate, sell it to the restaurants in San Francisco to pay our expenses. So we thought it was going to be kind of a weekend project.
I have some of the chocolate here with me, a few of the small bars that you often see at the mm-hmm. checkout counter, the dark chocolate with the roasted cocoa nibs.
And that's a
dark chocolate
one.
With freshly roasted coffee. So I don't mind that. In honor of Mr. Steinberg, I'm just going to sort of open some of this and
maybe even take
a nibble while we talk. What's the difference between what we consider to be good chocolate now and what used to pass for good chocolate?
You know, I don't really know. I think what we do at Scharfenberger is pay careful attention to what goes into the chocolate. I came from a winemaking background, and in that craft, what you need to do is look very carefully at what the grapes are like. You're really taking the flavor of those grapes and putting it into wine. And really, that's the protocol that we chose in making our chocolate. Robert was a very keen adventurer and found beans from really interesting parts of the world, Venezuela particularly, but also Trinidad, Madagascar, Papua New Guinea. And so we would taste these cacao nibs or the beans themselves, much the way I used to try base wines in the Champagne world. And really what we are just trying to do is make that flavor, the best flavors from the best beans come into that bar. Kind of our mantra is to try and, you know, make it from bean to bar and make it really delicious.
John Scharfenberger is the co-founder of Scharfenberger Chocolate Maker. He was speaking to us about his friend and his business partner, Robert Steinberg, who died this week at the age of 61. Mr. Scharfenberger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.